Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now onto the episode. Before we get into the episode, I just wanted to share some exciting news. I'm in the process of developing an app which includes a free protein tracking tool. Similar to other apps where you can track your protein, carbohydrates, fats, and calories, my version of this app will be for protein only. And the reason for this is because over the years, so many of my clients and myself really just wanted to know how much protein we were getting each day, because protein is the number one nutrient or food group where most of my clients are falling short, and the number one nutrient to make sure we're getting optimal amounts of, especially as we move past 40. But a lot of my clients didn't want to see their calories or track other macros at the same time. Some said that it could be quite triggering because they were brought up, you know, in the typical dieting era of the 80s and 90s, and they maybe had a history of being obsessed with calories, and this is something that they just didn't want to have to look at every day. So many people asked, is there just a way that I can track protein only? So I'm hoping to answer this problem with my app. And in November, I'm looking for as many people as possible who'd be willing to test it out over a period of about 2 weeks and provide feedback. And then we'll continue to develop the app based on your feedback. And it should hopefully be ready to go live in early 2025. So if tracking your daily protein intake is something that's important to you, which I really hope it is, and you'd be interested in testing out the app in November, then you can sign up to be a beta tester via the link that I'll put in the show notes. You can also find this link in my Instagram bio if you're following me over there. Okay, now on to the episode. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast with me, your host, Francesca. So in today's episode, I wanted to dive into the first of the foundational pillars that I talked about in the previous episode. So that would be episode 11, where I talked about the sort of foundations of health that really do need to be addressed and sort of in place in order for us to have a much easier time throughout our 40s and, you know, from late 30s, throughout our whole 40s, and eventually as we get to menopause as well. And they were blood sugar balance, sleep and healthy circadian rhythms, stress management and good nervous system support, and then nourishing and muscle building movement and exercise. So those were the four that I discussed last week. And then I said that I was going to do a separate episode on each one. So today I wanted to talk about the first one of the four, which is supporting good blood sugar balance. So in this episode, I'm going to take us through what blood sugar balance actually means, why it matters, and how do we achieve healthy blood sugar balance. And as part of that, I'm also talking about the situation of insulin resistance, which I'll discuss. So basically, we also want to be managing our blood sugar levels, but also controlling insulin, which comes from having good blood sugar regulation in the first place. So I'll explain all of that and why, how we get to a point of insulin resistance, what that means, how we might know that we're there, and then the things that we can do to support it, because that's the good news. I'll take us through what it all means and what it can cause, but then the good news being that we can support this whole thing. We have so much control over it. So I'll be getting into that as well. So blood sugar balance refers to the amount of sugar or glucose. So when I say sugar, blood sugar, I'm referring to blood glucose, or when I say blood glucose, it's sugar. It's the same thing. So blood sugar balance refers to the amount of glucose in your bloodstream at any one time. And for good health, we need this level to be within the healthy range, so aka in balance. Now, blood sugar regulation, you know, it's the same thing. We can call it blood sugar balance. We can call it blood sugar regulation. It's the same thing. It's having levels of glucose or sugar in the bloodstream within a healthy range, so that they're regulated well. Now, the level of sugar in your bloodstream, it will naturally rise and fall throughout the day. And there's a very clever physiological mechanism within the body that senses our blood sugar levels at all times and works to keep it regulated, or tries to keep it regulated. Now, we as human beings can do things throughout the day that cause the blood sugar levels to like rise and fall outside of the ideal range. So the opposite of blood sugar balance would be blood sugar swings. And that's basically when your blood sugar levels fluctuate too high and too low across the day. So they're going high above, outside of the healthy range, and then they're falling low, below, outside of that healthy range. And these blood sugar swings, they drain our energy, they affect our concentration, our focus, they can fog our brain, they upset our mood, they mess with our sleep, they lead to excess fat storage, particularly around the middle. Swinging blood glucose levels also leads to cravings as well. So specifically for sugar and refined carbohydrates. And sometimes those cravings can be really intense. So the main hormones responsible for keeping your blood sugar levels regulated within that healthy fluctuation range are insulin, glucagon, and cortisol, and adrenaline. There's others as well, but we're just going to focus on these four today, with insulin and cortisol being the two sort of main players. So insulin is a hormone produced by the cells of the pancreas known as beta cells in response to sugar or glucose being detected in the bloodstream. So for example, after eating. Now, insulin's job is to lower blood glucose levels. So it does this by facilitating the uptake of glucose into your cells, particularly within the muscle, where that glucose can be used for energy. Some of the glucose is also stored in the liver and muscle cells to be used later, which is in a storage form of glucose known as glycogen. Remaining glucose is stored in fat cells in the form of body fat, also known as adipose tissue. Now, most of that is stored around your midsection, and whether or not we have remaining glucose left to be stored as fat would be, for example, if the meal that we had was too high in sugar or too high in carbohydrates or refined carbohydrates specifically, then we're more likely to have excess blood sugar. And then if we have excess blood sugar, once the cells are full, then insulin will have no choice but to store the excess, the leftover glucose that's still around. It shoves it into the fat cells. So that's the kind of main reason why that ends up happening. And then we have glucagon. So glucagon is also secreted by the pancreas, but it's released by the alpha cells rather than the beta cells, which is where insulin comes from. And its job is to increase blood glucose levels, so opposite to insulin. And it does that by stimulating the breakdown of that storage form of glucose I just mentioned, known as glycogen. So glucagon will stimulate the breakdown of that glycogen into glucose. It does that in the liver, and that raises your blood sugar levels kind of back up again in response to them being too low. And then you've got adrenaline, which is a stress hormone produced by the adrenal glands. So these are the stress response glands in the body, and it raises blood glucose levels during like an acute stressor in the moment as part of the fight or flight stress response. And it does that through the breakdown of that stored glucose, so glycogen in the liver and muscles. It turns it into glucose, liberating it back into the bloodstream. So it's basically released in response to physical or emotional stress, leading to a rapid increase in available glucose for energy, basically. So as part of the fight or flight response, we have, blood pressure rises. I talked about this in the cortisol stress episode. Blood pressure rises, and so does blood sugar. So that's just part of the fight or flight stress response. And it's adrenaline that's responsible for doing that. So this is an example of how stress can lead to increases in belly fat, or sort of prevent fat loss. And then we can also say the same for cortisol, the other stress hormone also released by the adrenal glands. This increases blood sugar levels during prolonged stress. So first of all, adrenaline is responsible for that fight or flight, quickly, get more sugar in the bloodstream to give us energy to fight or to flee. We get our blood pressure up, for example. Cortisol comes later. So when that stressor is chronic, when it's prolonged. So as an example, chronic modern day stress. So no longer is it just an acute stress that goes away, you know, happens really few and far between, and then it goes away. Our modern day stress is more of the prolonged chronic stress. So when the brain and body picks up on this, cortisol is that stress hormone that's more sort of sustained. It's to sustain higher blood sugar levels to help us to kind of deal with that stress that's just not going away. So cortisol promotes the breakdown again of that stored glucose, that glycogen, into glucose like adrenaline did, liberating it into the system. But this is more of a chronic situation now rather than just that acute thing that adrenaline does. Cortisol also produces glucose for the bloodstream by breaking down proteins from muscle tissue. So this is really important to understand as well, because it means it can break down the lean muscle that we have and turn it into glucose, which then in turn gets turned into body fat. So it's a big concept to be aware of, because again, it shows how stress can increase belly fat and or prevent fat loss and also degrade our muscle mass, which is not what we want. So to summarize, after eating, insulin is released, where it shuttles glucose out of the bloodstream into the cells for instant use and also for storage to be used later when it needs to tap into those stores. And then during fasting or exercise or any other kind of stressor, and because we're fasting too much for what we can handle or exercising too much for what we can handle at that time, glucagon, adrenaline and cortisol raise blood glucose. So we've kind of got this ping pong game happening all day in a bid to keep our blood glucose levels regulated within the ideal range of fluctuation. So that's a bit of background about the mechanisms. But what's really important to take away from this is that our food choices and also our lifestyle habits, which we'll talk about in a minute, impact how much sugar is sent into the bloodstream as a result of food breakdown, basically. Now, the more sugar there is in the meal, or the more sugar that that meal breaks down into, the more insulin we need to produce. The more insulin we need to produce, the more fat that we store, particularly around the midsection. And the more likely it is that our cells become eventually resistant to insulin. This soon then becomes a situation known as insulin resistance. Insulin resistance precedes type 2 diabetes if it's left unaddressed. So that's the sort of food part of it, but also stress. The more stress we have, the more chronic our stress is, the more things that we're doing in our day-to-day life that create a situation that, you know, this chronic stress, including too much of the typical cortisol inducing exercise styles like spin classes, these long HIIT classes, long distance running, all this kind of cortisol inducing exercise, as well as things like under eating or low calorie diet, low fat diet, prolonged periods of fasting that go beyond your current capacity for it, which I just sort of touched on, then the more muscle that we break down, and the more fat that we store, because remember, the more cortisol we have, the more chance there is of that cortisol breaking down our muscle mass in order to send glucose, to liberate glucose into the bloodstream to help us deal with all of this stress. And then that glucose ends up getting stored as body fat. So this isn't just about how we look, it's about health. Healthy muscle mass is integral to good health and longevity, healthy aging. Fat mass within the healthy range, particularly visceral fat, that active fat that sits around our organs, which blood sugar dysregulation contributes to, these are health risks. So it's really important that we are managing our blood sugar levels successfully and preventing or trying to reverse a situation of insulin resistance. And the older we get, the less efficient we are at managing our blood sugar. So for example, in our 20s and 30s, we could possibly get away with, in inverted commas, more sugar, more refined carbs, more treat days, for example, than we can in our 40s. Because as we go past late 30s, move into our 40s and upwards, our cells become more susceptible to insulin resistance. Our cells aren't as efficient as soaking up glucose as they were in our 20s and 30s. So that means that we just need to be more aware of that and know that this is a health risk and something that we want to be addressing. So we want to be looking at our diet. We want to be looking at our stress and sleep and things like that. And we'll talk about that more in a moment. But also not to mention how the situation of insulin resistance impacts our experience of perimenopause in terms of symptoms. And it exacerbates the hormone shifts that we're already experiencing that are causing symptoms like the the estrogen roller coaster that I've described so many times in previous episodes, and the decline in progesterone. This situation is made worse by a situation of insulin resistance. For example, we need glucose to be able to reach the, so where I'm talking about the cells taking up glucose, I'm talking about the cells in the body, but also the brain. And we need glucose to reach the cells of the brain efficiently for brain energy. So to think clearly, to learn, to remember, to prevent headaches, to prevent brain fog, and, you know, and so on. And the same goes for energy for our muscles in the body. We need to fuel our cells with glucose efficiently so that we can move freely and easily without feeling lethargic or weak. But when your cells are resistant to insulin, it means less efficient glucose uptake by the cells of the body and the brain, and less energy is available. And this is because the glucose cannot be shuttled into the cells to fuel what's known as your mitochondria. So mitochondria are small structures that are found in the fluid that surrounds the cell, the kind of nucleus. It's like the inner part of the cell. In every cell that produce these mitochondrial structures produce energy. So we need that glucose to be able to get into the cell so it can fuel that mitochondria. So you might experience muscle aches, muscle weakness, body fatigue, and then also that brain stuff that I just mentioned. So let's look at how our food impacts our blood sugar levels, for good or for bad. So all carbohydrate foods, whether it's a potato or straight up sugar, get broken down during the digestive process into sugar, glucose. That sugar, glucose, enters the bloodstream. The pancreas detects it, and those beta cells of the pancreas secrete and release insulin into the bloodstream to go and meet that glucose and shuttle it out into your body and brain cells. So it can be used as energy straight away, quite soon. And some of it can also be stored in your muscle cells and also your liver cells in the form of this storage form of glucose called glycogen. But the muscle and liver cells, they only have a finite amount of space to hold glucose, you know, including their storage capacity. They're only small cells. So if we eat a meal or a food that's high in sugar or a refined carbohydrate, for example, that breaks down into a considerable amount of sugar once it's been eaten, it's likely to be an amount of sugar that takes your blood sugar levels outside of that high end of the healthy range. So we'd call this a blood sugar swing. We're getting this blood sugar high, and that is then followed swiftly by a low, a blood sugar low swing, because you'll need to make higher amounts of insulin in response to excess sugar being in the bloodstream, because the body's thinking, we've got too much sugar here. That means we're going to need more insulin because we need to get this sugar out quickly. So we're probably going to need more insulin to do this. But that then leads to a sharp drop in blood sugar because we've quickly got rid of sugar out of the bloodstream. We're now finishing up with this blood sugar low swing. Now, in response to a blood sugar low, which is a stressor to the body, the adrenal glands kick into action, releasing adrenaline and then cortisol in a bid to get your blood sugar level back up into the normal range. And so on over and over, as long as you keep eating foods and meals that are high in sugar or high in refined carbs, and even more so if they're low in protein, because protein slows the release of sugar into the bloodstream from the carbohydrate portion of the meal. So this is why I always say that if you're going to have a sweet treat, have it with or after some protein. And if you're having carbohydrates, always have it with protein because it slows their release into sugar. So after constant blood sugar elevations, soon the cells start ignoring the action of insulin. So where insulin's coming into the bloodstream, meeting that glucose and bringing it to the doors of your cells, and it's knocking on those doors and it's saying, take in this glucose, be efficient, take it all in. After a while, the cells start to ignore, you know, this is just in simple terms of explaining it. They start to ignore insulin's request. And that's what insulin resistance means. The cells are resistant. Now glucose remains in the bloodstream. The pancreas releases more insulin in response to this sugar remaining in the bloodstream. And now you're in a state of chronically elevated glucose and insulin with cells that aren't listening to insulin. They aren't taking it in. And soon this becomes type 2 diabetes if we don't do anything to reverse this situation and make ourselves sensitive to insulin again. So the opposite of insulin resistance is insulin sensitivity, is getting our cells sensitive to insulin, meaning they are more than happy to listen to insulin and soak in that glucose. So as well as the symptoms I've mentioned, insulin resistance can reduce our ability to ovulate, which you know is how we make progesterone. It leads to high blood pressure, high blood lipids, so triglycerides and cholesterol, if you were to look at blood work and see those two or one of them elevated. It leads to increases in visceral fat. So as I said, that's the fat that sits on our organs around the middle. You can't actually see it or grab it. But it can lead to increases in that, which is, it's metabolically active. So that can raise our risk of heart disease and type 2 diabetes. Insulin resistance impacts our sleep, our immunity. Cortisol is known as the stress hormone. And as I've explained already today, it's involved in keeping our blood sugar levels within healthy range. But it's also a crucial sleep hormone. It regulates your circadian rhythm, which I'll do a whole episode on, because sleep and circadian rhythm is one of the foundational pillars. So if cortisol is out of whack due to blood sugar swings throughout the day, then your sleep will also go out of whack. It might be harder to come by that night, every night, and or be less restorative when it does come. Insulin resistance impacts thyroid function. So research shows that elevations in insulin can interfere with the conversion of the inactive thyroid hormone T4 into the active thyroid hormone T3, leading to symptoms of hypothyroidism, which can also mimic some of the symptoms related to perimenopause. So that's why it's also really important that we're checking our thyroid health to make sure that we're keeping an eye on that. I'll also do a separate episode on thyroid. Blood sugar and insulin regulation is essentially just this foundational pillar of health. That's why I'm addressing it first. It's something we also have so much control over. So that's the good news. But before we look at things that support blood sugar balance and insulin control, let's run through some signs of insulin resistance. So firstly, you could be looking for energy changes, around mealtimes. So low energy before eating with a feeling of renewed energy or this like pick me up after a meal can be a sign of having too low blood sugar, also known as hypoglycemia, before you ate. So that's an imbalance in blood sugar, because we shouldn't have too low blood sugar before we eat, just like we shouldn't have high blood sugar after we eat. We want it to fluctuate up and down within the healthy range. So if we feel this low, really real sense of low energy before we eat, and then eating picks us up, that can be a sign that we got too low before we ate. Now, changes in energy after we've eaten can also be due to gut imbalances or food sensitivities. So if you do feel that your blood sugar regulation should be great, but you still have these sort of changes in energy after you eat, then it could be something to look into. That's just a side note. So other signs of insulin resistance are that you're unable to go more than 2 hours without eating, because you're then starting to feel hungry and angry around that 2 hour mark, and you can't wait any longer. You have to eat to get that pick me up. If you're still hungry almost immediately after eating, which again can be a digestive issue, but sometimes can also be a blood sugar issue. If you're tired or lethargic after eating a meal, again, that can be due to food sensitivities, digestive issues, but can also be a sign of high blood sugar or high insulin. If you've got high blood pressure or high cholesterol, high triglycerides or high hemoglobin A1C, HbA1c on any blood work. If you have a tendency to carry extra weight around the midsection, around your belly, and you find it very difficult to lose that belly fat. If you have cravings for sweet or sort of starchy, crunchy carbohydrates, specifically refined carbohydrates, real intense cravings. If you have a reliance on coffee, for example, in the afternoon to keep you going. Mood swings that seem to be relieved by eating refined carbohydrates or sugar. A tendency to feel tired or fatigued in the afternoon or the early evening. If you have PCOS or skin tags or acne, these can be signs of insulin resistance, though PCOS is quite significantly linked to a situation of insulin resistance. Difficulty ovulating, which PCOS can cause, but insulin resistance is the sort of root cause of that issue. If you have morning fasted blood sugar or pre-meal blood sugar that's higher than 5.5 millimoles per liter, or the other metric is 100 milligrams per deciliter. The most common one that we use in the UK is millimoles per liter. So a morning fasted blood sugar or pre-meal blood sugar reading that's higher than 5.5 millimoles per liter, So optimal fasted level of blood sugar is between 3.9 and 5.4 millimoles per liter, or that's 70 to 99 milligrams per deciliter. While we're talking about testing, so hemoglobin A1C measures glucose attached to hemoglobin, which is what the H stands for, as it's used as an indicator of the average blood glucose levels in that person across approximately the last 3 months. So raised blood glucose levels over several weeks can be detected in an HbA1c blood test. It's measured as millimoles per mole or as a percentage. So the optimal levels for HbA1c are that they are below 40 millimoles per mole or 5.5% below. Pre-diabetes levels would be between 42 and 47 millimoles per mole, or between 5.5% and 6%. Diabetic levels would be above 48. Now, this is the optimal reference ranges. Your conventional GP reference ranges might be a bit wider than this, but really for optimum health, we are looking for your HbA1c to be below 40. But I do think the conventional ranges are quite close to this, if not the same. So let's get back to some of the positive stuff and talk about the things that support good blood sugar balance and insulin sensitivity. So eating a good amount of protein, so by good amount of protein, I mean around 30, minimum 30, but preferably up to 40 grams of pure protein with every meal. As a day intake, this could be a minimum of 1.5 grams of protein per kilo of your body weight. And then you split that out between three meals, which should be around 30 to 40 grams of protein with every meal. And very importantly as well, keeping carbohydrate portions in check. So one closed fist size portion is a good size for most people. So close your fist and like up to your wrist. That is the portion size, the ideal portion size that we should be having of carbohydrate with our meals. Not more than that, which is quite common. A lot of people will fill half their plate or even three quarters of their plate with the carbs, and then they'll have a little bit of protein and some vegetables. We want to kind of switch that ratio around. So taller or younger people, people with a lot more muscle, people who regularly lift weights and have insulin sensitive cells can probably have more than one fist size at any with certain meals, for example, after training. But for the average woman during perimenopause, we should be ideally sticking to that one fist size with our meals. Plus use complex fiber-rich carbohydrates over the refined, I call them empty carbohydrates. So anything that's made with white flour, like wraps, bagels, baguettes, pastries, pasta. These are your refined carbohydrates. They break down very quickly and easily into sugar. So this is the kind of stuff that, you know, let's say you're relying on a wrap or a baguette every day for lunch, you're not going to be able to get much protein in there. You can get some protein in there, but it won't be much. You know, you can't fit a whole chicken breast into one baguette. I'm sure some people can, but that's not the norm, especially if you're picking them up from shops. So you're essentially having a very refined carbohydrate heavy meal that's going to break down into quite a lot of glucose, and it won't have enough protein there to buffer that, you know, to slow down that release. So good examples of complex fiber-rich carbs that you want one fist size, one closed fist size of would be baby new potatoes, sweet potatoes, other root vegetables like your butternut squash, carrots, for example, beetroot, yam. And then brown rice, wild rice, quinoa, buckwheat. So you could have pasta made from buckwheat or pasta that's made from brown rice as opposed to your white flour. Noodles made from buckwheat as well is a good option. And again, that one closed fist size portion. And then ideally having half a plate of vegetables, or whether they're cooked raw, whether it's salad, however you like to eat your veg, your plants. Fill half your plate because that's full of lovely fiber, which also really helps to slow down that release of glucose. And you're also filling up more on that than you are on the, let's say, you know, the refined carbohydrate portion or the carbohydrate portion that you might have. Good fats, plenty of good fats with your meals, also really helpful for blood sugar regulation. So your olive oil, coconut products, real butter, nuts, seeds, And if you eat snacks in your day, make them protein and or fat based rather than carb based, like, you know, so-called healthy snack bars, which are essentially just full of dried fruit and cereal grains and things like that. So quite high in sugar, even though the ingredients themselves might be natural and so, you know, healthy. So look out for so-called healthy bars that are marketed as healthy, natural, high in protein. Most of them are just high in sugar. So other healthy alternatives, if you do need to snack, so for example, between lunch and dinner, you might need a snack to bridge that gap so that you don't allow your blood sugar levels to drop too low, would be like maybe some nuts and some berries, some, you know, almonds, cashews, walnuts, any nuts that you like. You could have some dark chocolate above 70%, ideal to start training your taste buds to enjoy 85%, maybe with some nuts. You could have some mashed avocado on a slice of proper rye bread, a tin of sardines on some rye toast. You could have boiled eggs, you could have cooked chicken with avocado. You could have a natural yogurt, whether it's natural Greek dairy yogurt or the coconut alternative yogurts, as long as it's natural, unflavored. You could add some berries. So there's lots of different options for snacks that are fat and protein based rather than carbohydrate. Ideally as well, an overnight fast of a minimum of 12 hours, but anywhere up to 16 hours. Now I've done an episode, I think it was episode 7 on intermittent fasting, where I do talk about the fact that the sweet spot for a lot of women during perimenopause and menopause is actually 14 hours overnight fast. So 14 hours between finishing dinner and starting breakfast the next day. 13 to 14 hours. 16 can be pushing it too much for some people. A lot of women in the perimenopause phase, because we are naturally in a higher cortisol state because of the shift in hormones of estrogen and progesterone, we might find that 16 hours pushes our system too much and hammers on our adrenal glands and provides that sort of stressor to the body. And we now have low blood sugar. And then we get our adrenal glands having to release adrenaline and cortisol in response to the prolonged fast. So I've sort of touched on that a little bit earlier. So 12 hours fast overnight is great. Maybe 13, maybe 14. My sweet spot is 14. It works really well for me. And then ideally, we're not snacking throughout the day. We're just having those three square meals balanced out with plenty of protein, 1/5 size of complex carbohydrates, plenty of vegetables in whatever form you like. And then we're not needing to snack between our meals because we're eating enough to sustain us until our next meal. But if between, for example, lunch and dinner, there's a longer gap than there would be, say, between breakfast and lunch, then you may need to put a snack in. I know I certainly do sometimes, especially if I go to the gym in between lunch and dinner. But make it protein, fat-based, as opposed to carbohydrate-based. So the ideas I just gave you, a good quality small protein smoothie as well can be something to use. Lifting weights or strength training, whichever word you want to use, has been shown to support insulin sensitivity because it has been shown to efficiently drive glucose into the cells, which is essentially what insulin sensitivity is. It's the cells efficiently uptaking glucose and not ignoring the action of insulin. And lifting weights has been shown to improve this situation. Muscle mass, so the more muscle we have, so for example, the more we're lifting weights, the more protein we're eating, the more muscle mass we're building and that we keep hold of, it can make us more of like a glucose sink. So meaning that our cells are more efficient at soaking up glucose, and that's what insulin sensitivity is. So that's a great combination, plenty of protein with your meals, your overnight fast, avoiding snacking or having protein snacks if need be, lifting weights 2 to 3 times a week or 2 to 4 times a week, whatever works for you, and holding on to that muscle mass, building new muscle mass, and then also sleeping well, keeping your body clock in sync. So one night of poor sleep in research has been shown to dysregulate blood sugar levels the next day. So we're naturally in a blood sugar dysregulated state. We're in that blood sugar swing state just from having poor sleep. So even just after one night. So imagine if we have continuous poor sleep, it's going to be harder for our bodies to regulate those blood sugar regulating hormones that I described. It's going to be harder for those to do their job and keep blood sugar levels in sync. Now, let alone if we're also adding insult to injury by eating high refined carbohydrates, high sugar, low protein, low fat, low vegetables, then it's also going to be much harder then, even more so, to keep your blood sugar levels regulated. So that the dietary advice I've just explained is really, really important, and even more important if you're struggling to sleep well. So the circadian clock, which I'm going to talk about in the next episode when I talk about sleep as one of the foundational pillars. Remember, because cortisol is so heavily involved in our internal body clock and our sleep patterns, because blood sugar dysregulation creates dysregulation in cortisol, which therefore impacts sleep, we also know a body clock that's out of rhythm has been shown to increase insulin resistance. So it can kind of be a vicious cycle. Managing stress, including looking at your exercise, because as I mentioned earlier, I touched on the fact that some really intense high cardio based exercise sort of styles and classes like the spin, the long HIIT classes, your F45, your boot camps, your long distance running, these can increase cortisol just like regular stress does. And so that again will just further impact blood sugar regulation. Limiting or avoiding alcohol also very much helps. So this is not popular opinion at all. There's many reasons why alcohol just does not work for us during perimenopause and beyond. And it's something we might do really well to rethink. But while your liver is processing alcohol, it stops releasing glucose. And as a result of that, it means we get this sharp drop, very quick drop in blood sugar levels in the presence of alcohol, which can put us at risk of low blood sugar, which is hypoglycemia. That's a blood sugar swing on a low level. And that's always going to be followed with a blood sugar high. So it's just going to perpetuate the blood sugar swing issue, dysregulation. So let me just go back to the carb and sugar side of things. So a normal amount of sugar or glucose to be present in the bloodstream at any one time for good health is around 1 teaspoon, roughly. So that's the equivalent of about 4.4 grams. I say about, but that's quite exact. So 4.4 or 4 grams, let's say roughly, is the equivalent of a teaspoon of sugar. And that normal healthy amount at any one time in the bloodstream is around 1 teaspoon. So imagine that you eat something that contains 4 teaspoons of sugar. You can check labels for this. Or an amount of carbohydrates that breaks down very quickly. So your refined white flour carbs that break down very quickly into sugar straight away, that breaks down into, say, 4 or 5 teaspoons equivalent of sugar. Then that's going to take you way over the high threshold. So, you know, if 1 teaspoon is the amount that should only ever be present in the bloodstream, and now you're eating 4 or 5 teaspoons, you're going to have a blood sugar swing. Now you're going to get more insulin to help you bring down this excess blood sugar. We're now going to get quickly low blood sugar. Now we're going to get cortisol being released in response to this low blood sugar, which is a physiological stressor. And cortisol is going to liberate glucose into the bloodstream from maybe your muscle mass, for example. Remember, I said it breaks down your muscle mass, and so on, over and over and over again. So one-offs here and there of, you know, you might go out, I'm going to use myself as an example. Every Saturday I go out and get this great chocolate brownie that I found local to me, and I love it. I have it every week, and I don't worry about it. You know, and I might have other things as well here and there. I don't stress about them because my norm is the 3 square balanced meals every day, high protein, no sugar really in my diet apart from 85% dark chocolate, some fruit here and there. But other than that, I'm not having these blood sugar swings. So every so often, a one-off is probably okay, not going to be an issue. But all the time, having these blood sugar swings high and low, that's not good. And that's what leads to the situation eventually of insulin resistance, which can then turn itself into type 2 diabetes. So for example, someone relying on cereal for breakfast, a snack bar mid-morning that they believe to be healthy, but it's just full of sugar, dates, dried fruits, etc., a low protein, high carb lunch, followed by a low protein, high carb dinner, let's say a big bowl of pasta with hardly any meat in it, or protein, other sources of protein, crackers as a snack for what they think is a healthy snack. You know, this situation is going to cause these blood sugar highs and lows throughout the day. So thinking, going back to the, you know, what I just mentioned about the dietary advice, switching to complex carbs, sticking to 1/5 size, having plenty of protein, having plenty of veg and good fats. And when it comes to foods that you're eating that contain, you know, that are wrappers, so any kind of processed stuff that's got a wrapper on it, a so-called healthy bar, whatever it might be, a high protein bar, read the label and look at how much of which sugars. So where it says carbohydrates, underneath that it says of which sugars. How much of which sugars per 100 grams, and then know how many grams of that product you're eating. So if you're eating a, let's say you're eating a bar and it is 100 grams, And it says, the label says, of which sugars, I don't know, 40 grams of sugar, divide that by four, you've got 10 teaspoons, the equivalent of 10 teaspoons of sugar. Because remember, there's about 4 grams of sugar in a teaspoon. So if you're having 50 grams of that bar, you're having 5 teaspoons of sugar. So just always know how much sugar that you are eating. You know, if, like I said, if you're going out to enjoy a cake or some kind of sugary thing to enjoy it, and you know what you're doing, you know you're going out to have a piece of cake, that's fine. Ignore that. It's when, like, start to look at the things that you're doing on a day-to-day basis, the foods that you're relying on, because you think they're healthy, you think they're okay. But actually, when you dig deeper and look at that label, you're seeing that you're having 5 teaspoons of sugar with this, 5 teaspoons of sugar with this, 6 with that. You're having a drink that's supposedly healthy, you know, a kombucha, but it's got added sugar. And when you actually look of which sugars, you're seeing that you're drinking, like, you know, the same as what you'd have in a can of Coke. So be careful with labels, check them, you know, and just that way you're going to eliminate so much sugar without really missing much, you know, rather than saying, right, I have to go sugar free and I can't ever have a cake, I can't ever have a chocolate bar. Yes, you can, because you can probably actually start with all of the low hanging fruit and eliminate a hell of a lot of sugar coming into your diet, and switch your refined carbs for your complex carbs, the examples I've given already. And that will really, really put you in good stead to start balancing your blood sugar levels better. So I really hope this episode has been helpful and that you've learned something new. And you can see the link between blood sugar balance, insulin resistance, and your experience of perimenopause, and, you know, the symptoms and your health. So thank you for listening, and I will see you in the next episode. Bye-bye. If you found this episode helpful, then please share it with anyone else who you think could benefit. And consider leaving a rating and a review, as this will help the podcast to reach and help more people. And if you need more guidance on your own health journey, you can grab my free guide, 6 Steps to Mastering Your Hormones in Your 40s, over at francescaliparotti.com, where you can sign up for your free copy. Or you'll also find the link in the show notes.